The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Mayor Lightfoot is approaching her 2-year anniversary in office, and she says she's going to be giving one-on-one interviews about this with the media, but only to journalists of color.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. Thank you for being here. That was Fox 32 in Chicago. They were covering what some believe is really a disturbing report. And I'll get you plugged into something I do want to talk to you about. I want your take on this. I want to know whether or not the mayor of Chicago is simply making a statement or whether or not this is really an attack on our First Amendment. Is she using racism to fight racism? I don't know if you heard the story about Mayor Lightfoot not taking interviews from white reporters. Oh, man. When I heard that this morning, I'm like, are you kidding me? Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm not taking any interviews from a white reporter. Okay, so the pigment of someone's skin, the color of their skin, determines whether or not you're going to do that. What's behind this? You know, we'll talk about that coming up. We'll talk about whether she's just trying to make a statement or whether or not we really should be concerned about critical race theory, this fight of fighting racism with racism. And you'll hear from some great people. But let me start with good news. All right, let's start with something positive. All right, just a couple of quick news items for you here to kick it off. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, he has just signed a bill that bans abortions after a heartbeat's detected. And that usually happens, you know, somewhere around 6 weeks. The new law goes into effect in September, and it goes even further than that. It allows people now to sue their doctors who mislead them to perform abortions after the heartbeat's been detected. So this is a major victory for life. If you want good news, and I'm sure you do, let me get you plugged in to just a little bit more. Here's Texas Greg Abbott. He signed that pro-life legislation. WFAA-TV reported on it.
Our Creator endowed us with the right to life.
The governor celebrated signing the bill on Twitter.
And yet, millions of children lose their right to life every year.
The heartbeat bill banning abortion as early as 6 weeks when a heartbeat can be detected and changing how it would be enforced, allowing any private citizen to sue an abortion provider, someone who doesn't need to be connected to a patient or even live in Texas. Anyone who successfully sues can collect a minimum of $10,000, and abortion clinics sued unjustly cannot recover legal fees. As the governor signed the heartbeat bill, Rebecca Parma with Texas Right to Life was in this crowd, prepared for the coming legal fight and watching Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban already headed to the Supreme Court.
We don't mind going to the courts and working through that process in order to ultimately overturn Roe v. Wade. That's really important to the overall legal strategy.
Yeah, one other twist on this story, and we'll continue to cover this, but there's been a lot of pro-life victories all across the country. We know there's a case now making its way before the Supreme Court, and we are going to see, I think, two things happen. One, I think there's going to be possibly a race to pack the Supreme Court, to expand it to maybe 13 or 15 members. Although, you know, Nancy Pelosi, I was struck by this the other day. I heard she said she will not take that to the floor. So if Nancy Pelosi's not behind it, great. But do you buy that? I'm not sure. Then again, you know, we're going to see the fight for life ensue if the Supreme Court sees this, if they rule in favor of the child. And of course, it will descend then to the state. So the battle continues. But we're at a critical crossroads here, and Roe v. Wade is in the crosshairs. In terms of the Abbott story, just one final note here. Here's a little twist. According to the Texas Tribune, the person who sues, right, you wouldn't even have to be connected to the woman who had the abortion. I was struck by that, or even to the provider to sue. So the law is going to be challenged in courts. And although the upcoming Supreme Court, the court case I was referring to is Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Medical, they're probably going to have an impact on any court case that comes as a result of the law. So Texas is not the first state with this kind of law. It's the largest one to pass it. And my hat off to Governor Abbott and to the great citizens of the Lone Star State. Bravo. You're taking a step in the right direction. One final story here, and then we could talk about Mayor Lightfoot. I'd love to get your take on that. It looks like the pandemic here in the U.S., some more good news for you. It's starting to come to an end. I saw a headline earlier today that for the first time, several states around the country have had days where they have had zero deaths due to COVID-19. Texas had their first one on Tuesday. You had Idaho and Minnesota and the great state of Wisconsin. They've had several days in the past couple of weeks. Zero deaths. So are we seeing light at the end of the tunnel? Are we getting out of the woods, so to speak? The Epoch Times reported that cases dropped to a 10-month low in the United States last week. It hit about 36,000, maybe a little bit over than that per day average. And hospitalizations have decreased for all age groups, including one of the most vulnerable populations, those 65 and older, with just 8,900 intensive care unit beds occupied by COVID-19 patients. So deaths nationwide have dropped to a seven-day average and of about 546. That's the lowest since March of last year. So there's some good news for you to start off. We will see what the future holds. We're seeing 60% of the population vaccinated right now, right? We're seeing 60% of the population vaccinated. There's talks of possibly boosters, and of course, we're now entering the summer months. So when the fall comes around, we'll see what happens. A lot of people losing the masks, too. Will that create a spike? We'll see. We'll talk more about that, you know, in the days ahead. But I want to get to Mayor Lightfoot. I think this is an important story to discuss. Honestly, I've got to sit back here, just as a journalist, somebody who's been trained in that field. It's really very shocking how far the ideal that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. outlined, right? Remember his I Have a Dream speech, one of the great speeches in American history. You know, there's a key phrase everybody loves to reiterate. It's one of the most powerful lines, I think, in his speech. And he said in this, he aspired to a day when his children would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. We should all aspire to that, right? And I'm sure you do. He looked forward to a day when his children would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. That, of course, is how all of us should be judged, by the content of our character. Not about our skin color. It has nothing to do with what you look like. The color your skin is, your hair is, your eyes is silly. You know, it's just silly. It's just silly. You know, people are being categorized or being put in boxes. It's about identity politics. There's a growing movement away from that, unfortunately, especially among young people who have been preaching, you know, tolerance for many years. So we've seen this especially in higher education, where some of the most elite schools, right, they have now separate graduation for specific skin colors. You probably are as shocked as I am when I heard that. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? This is the United States of America, where you have schools having separate graduation for specific skin color. Apparently those of darker skin color didn't feel, you know, they don't want them to feel threatened by those who have lighter skin color. And again, look, I want to be very charitable about this as I approach it. And I don't know what it's like to be a person of darker skin color, to drive while black, as many people say. I want to be very sensitive to that issue. But you've got to agree with me. This is absolutely ridiculous that you're going to separate graduating classes due to their skin color. One of my roommates in college was black, right? It's like, okay, you got to go to your own graduation and I'm going to go to mine, right? We can room together, but we can't attend graduation together. It's the silliest thing I've heard. Well, now it's moving into the halls of government. This is where we're seeing it, especially among, you know, the people who've been preaching tolerance for so many years. It's so funny, that word tolerance, too. You can be tolerant of everything, right? Except for those people who have a different viewpoint than yours, right? It's okay to accept. Jake just said to me in my headset, that's a great line, Jake. Open your mic. I think that's great. It's so true in some respects.
I might get in trouble for this here, but I can't credit myself for coming up with this, but I've heard someone say that liberals sometimes make the most conservative people. They make the best conservatives.
That's really true. So. That's really true. Yeah, look, you see it in higher education, where some of the most elite schools, we have these separate graduation classes, I said. This is just enough. So now I'll bring you up to speed on what's happening in the halls of government, right? Lori Lightfoot, She is, of course, the mayor in Chicago. Congratulations, Mayor Lightfoot, celebrating her second anniversary of her inauguration there. Guess how she's celebrating it, though? She's telling reporters that from now on, she's only going to give individual interviews to black or brown people. Yeah, I know, you heard me right. Hey, look, those aren't my words. I'm not paraphrasing. Those were her words. Here's some audio from the AP. We'll tell you more.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot has made equity and inclusion a major focus of her first 2 years in office, and in deciding to take aim at the media, she said she has been struck by the, quote, overwhelming whiteness and maleness of Chicago media outlets from the boardroom to the press room. In a two-page letter to members of the media, she wrote, "It is impossible for this glaring lack of diversity not to be reflected in the daily coverage of government, politics, and city life every single day." Former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas, who covered City Hall for nearly 10 years, sees the mayor's move as an attempt to distract from other more important issues.
Is the crisis diversity or is the crisis crime? I would suggest to you that a bigger crisis is crime. A bigger crisis is city finances. A bigger crisis is public education in a city where the schools, the public schools, have been closed for a year and a semester.
All right, so Mayor Lightfoot, she defended her position. She talked to someone at WGN-TV in Chicago and explained why she's doing this. So from her own mouth, here's her rationale.
Well, look, I think in this one day, when we are looking at the two-year anniversary of my inauguration, as a woman of color, as a lesbian, it's important to me that diversity is put front and center.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot defending her most unusual decision to only invite black and brown journalists to her office for one-on-one interviews. The move infuriated the mostly white City Hall press corps. The outrage exploded on Twitter. One Latino newspaper reporter wrote, "He agreed to the sit-down but backed out to make a point."
If I, as the black woman mayor, the first ever, don't challenge us, the collective us, to do better, to really make sure that in every institution, it reflects the diversity and nuance and texture of our city, then shame on me.
Mayor Lightfoot is known to clash with opponents or those who question her. Reporting on leaked emails revealed the mayor, upset about critical reporting and commentary, canceled her Chicago Tribune subscription.
There are some folks you've been feuding with, some of them my white colleagues. Some people look at this as sort of a payback.
It has nothing to do with that. The facts are the facts. Look at the people who cover City Hall.
All right, so there she is defending her particular position. You can join me if you want to sound off. Dr. Bill Thorne's going to be joining me in a second here. A great professor of journalism. Love to get his take on it. The number to get in, 888-914-9149. Jake, you and I were talking before the show as we were looking at that particular piece of audio, and I was struck by how she identified herself as a woman of color, as a lesbian, and she goes through this checklist of who she is. It's like me sitting here. I'm a white, Catholic, heterosexual man. It's like they have all these identifiers. So you bring up your point. Your point that you were sharing with me.
Well, when she was going through that checklist, I was reminded of that recent news about the Walt Disney Company, how they were requiring employees to do, you know, a racial sensitivity training online. Yeah. And what the article was talking about was that these employees are actually given a checklist. It's called a white privilege checklist. So if you are white, if you're heterosexual, if you're a man, if you still identify as the gender you were born with, if you don't rely on public transportation or have never been called a terrorist, then apparently you have white privilege. So this is where we're at. Like the fact that we're Christian Catholics, the fact that we're white, apparently it's just like we're being put in that box to where we're the oppressors.
That's never been called a terrorist.
Yeah, but it's like this is what critical race theory is all about. Yep. If you don't fit into those boxes, then that makes you either the oppressor or the oppressed. We shouldn't be living in these boxes to begin with.
I agree with you. It's a great point, though. And I remember covering that Disney story last week or earlier in this week. All these boxes, all these different identifiers. Look, it's just I want to be fair. Because the other point here, and I saw an interview that was done by Lynn Sweat. I think that's how you say it. Sweat is her last name, Jake?
Yes, Sweat.
She's the Washington Bureau chief for the Sun
Sun-Times
in Chicago. And I guess CNN was talking to her, and Mayor Lightfoot put out her position. She's getting defense of her position from some journalist who say that, look, she does three press conferences a week, right? And they're open to anyone. So what she's doing here is trying to make a point, all right? She's trying to use this to make a point. That's not how the Chicago Tribune sees it. But here, listen to this. This is what Lynn Sweat said, trying to defend Mayor Lightfoot.
I've been part of the Chicago Press Corps for a long, long time. And Lori Lightfoot did not say anything that we did not know. So what's going on? For one day, she's trying to shake everybody up and shine a spotlight on the lack of diversity in the City Hall Press Corps. Now, I keep a foot in City Hall politics as well as covering Washington and the White House. Now, I can within an hour be on the phone with someone from Capitol Hill, the White House, and City Hall. So I know what Lightfoot's talking about. Chicago is a very diverse city. The newsrooms are not.
All right. So again, that's the Washington bureau chief for the Sun-Times. And I want to be fair. I mean, she's trying to make a point. She does hold other conferences, et cetera. Well, Bob Woodson, who's been on this program in the past, he's a great civil rights icon who's conservative. He was, I believe, on Laura Ingraham the other day, and he brought up a great point that the left doesn't really care about black people. Now, he's black himself, okay? He's the man who's making this case. Listen to the point he makes.
You know, they're using racism to conquer racism. I mean, we fought, as we said, we fought to get white pigs away from the trough, not to replace them with black pigs. We fought to get pigs away from the trough. And what they are doing is so insulting and demeaning to black America. The assumption is that unless and until white people change and reform, there's little we can do, as if we have no agency, that we have no understanding.
No, it's insulting, Bob. Your book is great.
Yeah, so I thought he was excellent. Laura jumped in on him, but bottom line, summary of his point, it's insulting. This is insulting to black America, he says. They're using racism to fight racism. And look, as a Catholic, we know what the church teaches very clear. Racism is an intrinsic evil, right? It's an intrinsic evil. I was mentioning that the Chicago Tribune doesn't see Mayor Lightfoot's position as being, they had a real problem with her position, you know, and there was actually a journalist of color he's a Latino reporter who was scheduled to do a one-on-one with her. That's great, right? When he found out that she would not take or do interviews with white reporters, he called the office to see if they were going to, what they were going to do, if they were still going to hold the interview. And they said, yeah, we're only black or people of color. When he realized they would not allow white reporters there, he canceled his own interview. And I think that is phenomenal. Look, let me do this. I'm going to take a short break. When we come back, let's talk about it. Dr. William Thorne, a professor emeritus of journalism and media studies at Marquette University, is on standby. We'll tap into his expertise and we'll discuss this. Again, this all goes into so much of what we've been talking about, critical race theory, you know, this woke nature of our culture so much. It's a different time, isn't it? I don't ever remember having this type of dialogue as frequently as I do today as I did in the past. Also, I want to talk to you a little bit about the death penalty coming up, too. There's a bizarre case that I want to make you aware of, okay? That and a whole lot more coming up. Short pause. Stay with me.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
If I, as the black woman mayor, the first ever, don't challenge us, the collective us, to do better, to really make sure that in every institution, it reflects the diversity and nuance and texture of our city, then shame on me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Mayor Lightfoot marking the second anniversary of her inauguration as the mayor of Chicago, telling reporters that from now on, she's not going to give individual interviews to black or brown. She's not going to give individual interviews to white people, only to black or brown people. Those were her words. I think she's trying to make a statement, but I think it should concern every American. My next guest, who's going to be joining me here, he was saying to me, journalism is the lifeblood of democracy. You can't pick and choose who you want to take interviews from and how that's going to, you know, be done. It's not good for America. It really is not. I'm joined today by a man who's taught journalism. He's a professor emeritus in media studies at Marquette University, and so it's good to talk to Dr. Thorne. Doctor, good afternoon. I appreciate you being
good
here.
Good afternoon.
Well, that was a shocking statement. She's got a lot of attention. There's a lot of people. There's some liberal television networks that are, you know, championing her position and making it seem very sane and rational. There's conservative ones out there that are waving a flag saying, hey, you got to be careful. Do you know what this portends? As a journalist, as a Catholic, what are the journalistic issues at stake when we're dealing with a politician who openly makes a statement like that? No, the pigment of your skin, if you're a dark-colored person, then I'll do an interview with you. If you're white, forget it. Give me the implications of that.
It's absolutely discriminatory, and the model that comes to my mind is Canada, where you have the French-speaking and the English-speaking parts because they agreed that they were so different they couldn't get along. And I see that as one of the things we were talking earlier about, the separate commencements for black and white students.
Yeah.
And the French-Canadian situation came to mind immediately. The hatred has not diminished at all between the French Canadians and the English speaking Canadians. And that separation is disastrous. It also does nothing to forward democracy.
Yep.
We're supposed to be not a melting pot, but a kind of ethnic stew, as one of the historians said, where there are lumps of Irish and lumps of Italians and lumps of Catholics and lumps of Protestants and lumps of British.
Yep.
And this flies in that face, especially in an area so sensitive to me as journalism, how government is covered. The central genius of our democracy is that the politicians are responsible for to the people, and they can be removed from office if they don't do well.
Yep.
The way you know that is to have good journalism, journalists who raise the ugly things, the bad things that the politicians don't want you to talk about. Like the shooting rate in Chicago. There's one black journalist in Chicago I read said, they're killing my people, and this seems to him to be a distraction from the fact that there is a shooting gallery on the south side of Chicago, that they're going to set a record for the number of shootings.
Yeah.
In any event, you don't get to pick who covers you as a politician. You have to put up with all kinds.
Yeah.
I
totally agree with you. This is bigger than just a racist ideology or gender politics or racial politics. I think this goes back. This is a direct assault, honestly, if you look at it, on our First Amendment, and that's the freedom of the press. I know you've taught this in the past, and you believe very much journalism is the lifeblood of democracy. Is Mayor Lightfoot, does she understand what she's doing here? Is she trying to make a point and justify this is a one-and-done type of thing? Or is this really a slippery slope to go down? Because you're telling certain press, no, you're not going to be able to, I'm not going to talk to you because of your skin color.
In an era of Marxist race theory, that is a problem. But in the past, back in the 1960s, the Kerner Commission found that there was a lack of minority representation in the newsroom in L.A. In order to find out where the Watts was during the riots, they had to go to a janitor because all the reporters were white. And that's been an ongoing problem. And the news media know that, and they've taken some small steps to try and correct it. But it's an ongoing issue within every newsroom, within every news organization. I was reading a piece by WBEZ in Chicago. The editor objected to her comments because he said two of his three city hall reporters are women. One's Hispanic and one is South Asian. So it's a bit of overkill, I think.
Yeah, I sit back here and I think, what if the mayor of Los Angeles, Garcetti, who happens to be white, says, no, I'm not going to take any interviews from women. right? You know, I'm only going to take them from men, the outrage. Or if he says, no, I'm not going to take them from anyone who's black. I'm only going to take them from whites or from Italians. There would be outrage. There would be total outrage. And yet we see the left here getting behind Mayor Lightfoot and making this seem rational and normal. You know, I love what Bob Woodson, a great civil rights icon, said. He said, it's insulting to black America. It really is. Because they're using racism to fight racism. Let's go to the phones. We'll take a few calls. Nancy's listening in Henderson, Nevada. If you want to get in, I only have Dr. Thorne for a few moments. Love to hear from you. It's 888-914-9149. You can sound off as well. Nancy, thanks for waiting so long. Good to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much for taking the call. I have one question, and it's a rhetorical question. Would you paint your house with a half an inch brush or a four-inch brush if you were going to paint the walls? Diversity to me means broad stroke. It doesn't mean a one-inch or a half-an-inch stream of paint that you're putting on the wall. That'll never get the job done. Right. Question I have, though, in introspection, how many, is there a number, is it obtainable, a percentage number of white people versus people of color that voted for her?
That's a great question. I don't know what the demographic breakdown was in Chicago.
I'm not looking at party lines. I'm looking at color lines, since that's what she's looking at. I grew up in Chicago. Yep. My hood was very diverse.
Yeah.
And we never had any arguments. We never had any real problems. We had some motorcycle gangs. We didn't have any real problems, though. We'd sit on the porch talking all night long, and nothing ever came of it. And I lived in a poor neighborhood. But we always got along, and we conversed with each other. Nothing like what's going on today.
Yeah. Well, hey, Nancy, thank you for the perspective. It's good to hear from you. Doctor, I'll let you respond as well and sound off. You heard her points.
I think it's a very good point. Chicago has always struck me from childhood as a delightful mix of ethnicity. You want good Greek food, you want good Italian food, you go to Chicago. You want all kinds of ethnic diversity, you go to Chicago, because they got along. That was not a source of contention. It was a source of pride. And the pride did not lead to this kind of division. But we live in an era of Marxist racial theory, where the goal is to set the races, set people against each other, checklist against checklist. And that plays into this, I think. It sets a context for it. I also think she says she's only going to do it for one day regarding her second anniversary. That could be seen as a warning shot, but I think it sets a bad precedent, and it raises all kinds of other issues.
Yeah. All right. My guest today, Dr. Bill Thorne. He is a professor of journalism. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about Mayor Lightfoot celebrating her second anniversary as mayor and her inauguration. And I chose not to take any interviews from white reporters. So shocking. A lot of debate over this issue now. And as you can see how polarized our country is, the different camps are taking positions, trying to defend both Mayor Lightfoot as well as to call out the insanity of it. Joanne is listening in Texas. Joanne, you're on the air with Dr. Bill Thorne. Good afternoon.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Well, thanks.
I grew up in Illinois, but I got to Texas as quick as I could. I have 2 points to make. One is, it seems to me that, in my humble opinion, that racism has flipped. It's now the blacks calling the whites, calling out the whites. I'm not sure if I'm saying what I mean to say the right way, but I think it has flipped over. It's now the white people who are the bad people. And it's ridiculous, because God made the human race all different colors. And the second point I want to make is, when she's pointing out people of color, I have been around the United States, and I've seen very few actual white people. I know down here in Texas, we're pretty dark.
Yeah.
And for her to say people of color, meaning only black and brown people, that's wrong. We have white people who are so-called white people who are dark-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
We have Hispanics down here. We have Asians. I'm not sure what she means by people of color, but I think she means just black and brown.
Yeah, all right.
And that in itself is another racist comment.
Yeah.
So we can't get rid of racism if we keep perpetuating it.
Yeah, thank you.
Like she's doing.
Thank you, Joanne. I do appreciate it. You're right. I mean, you don't fight racism with racism, right? That was Bob Woodward's point. I think that's a great thing. And I do think, you know, you can see where the pendulum has swung. A lot of people see that we have really gone to an extreme where if, as Jake pointed out a little bit earlier, if your skin is white, if you've never been called a terrorist, if Jake, what were some of the other points that you had brought up in that?
If you have relied on public transportation, then that would, well, if you haven't had to rely on public transportation,
then you've got white privilege.
You'd have to,
so,
yeah.
I mean, it's so wacky. It just it's. Yeah, Professor, let's talk about that for a moment. Reverse discrimination, if you will. And I don't know if that's even the right word to describe this right now. But how do you see things moving? I mean, hopefully we'll come back to the center. Hopefully we'll get rid of a racist, you know, ideology that seems to permeate this country right now. People look at each other through that particular lens. I don't like this concept of white privilege. I know a lot of people are adamant about that. I don't like what Mayor Lightfoot is doing. Your thoughts on where things have now gone and where do you see them either returning or going to?
Well, in the 60s, during all of that time, when I was a college student, it seemed to me that whites had all the power. And it seemed to me in the coverage since George Floyd's unfortunate murder that the power has shifted to the black side, so that they are the spokespeople who are setting the agenda, who are calling the shots, who are determining how we're going to look at things. Their lens is now the dominant lens, whereas it used to be white.
Yeah,
and I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Bill Thornton. Jake just found the data on who voted for Mayor Lightfoot, and how did that shake out? How did they vote?
So it's twofold here. The fact is that Mayor Lightfoot was not the most preferred mayoral candidate among black voters. A majority of black voters voted for a man named Willie Wilson, who is an African American. But what's really interesting here is that Mayor Lightfoot was the preferred candidate in the north side of Chicago, which is about half white.
Yeah.
So she did garner a lot of white support. Especially within the northern suburbs.
Yeah. All right.
And the more affluent side of Chicago.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. All right. We only have a moment or two left for the professor. Jake, do I have time for another call or do I have to wrap it up here? All right. Who's on deck, Jake? Let me see who's up next. Is it Alice listening in California? She'll be our last call for you, Doc. Go right ahead, Alice.
Hi. How are you guys?
We're well, thanks. Thanks for calling.
We're here.
Hi, I was just calling in regards to the views of the mayor. I don't necessarily agree with what she is saying. I don't believe that racism is going to, you know, you're not going to get anything good out of being racist. But I also do understand her point of view, because I think journalism has been, like you said, Professor, for a long time, journalism has been biased in a white perspective. And now that the tables have turned, like you mentioned, people are having a problem. But our people, brown people, have been suffering for hundreds of years, hundreds, not just decades. This is, as a Native American person,
right,
my people have been suffering for millions of years. And it's to the point where we are speaking out and fighting against something that has just, I mean, it's like they say, it's a beast.
Yep.
It's a horrible beast, what has been done to our people. And I think that some people are going to the extreme because there is no other way. We feel like there is no other way.
Okay.
Like you said, you've been, you know, involved in journalism for a really long time, and for so long. I mean, there's still news reporters that make really racist comments on national television.
All right.
A white woman, you know, and so, you know, as soon as one person also of color makes mm-hmm. a racist comment, it's all over the news. and people are super upset about it.
Alice,
it's very unfair.
Thank you for your call. I'm grateful that you got in. Professor, I'm going to let you respond. I only have a moment or two left for you here. You heard what Alice said. I'll give you final thoughts.
2 points. Native Americans have had a hard time breaking into journalism other than their own Native American press and getting a presence. In other words, being the first in line to get interviewed when something's going on in an area that affects them. The last time was at all significant in Wisconsin was when a federal judge allowed spearfishing in the spring, and it was there was a shooting involved. Nobody was hit. It was a shooting over the heads of some of the Native Americans who were going spearfishing. But otherwise, they seem to be invisible in the press and in the newsrooms and in the editorial boards. Yeah. The other point I was struck, we may be in a time where politicians are more sophisticated about picking who can interview them. I'm thinking of the shot of Biden's press conference, which showed his notebook with the pictures of the various reporters and numbers circled under him, who he was going to call on first, second, third.
Yeah.
That is a form of, and he did it, I think his predecessor did exactly the same thing out of memory.
Wow.
And that is disastrous.
No, I could not agree with you more. Well, Professor, I'm grateful for your time, your insight, especially your expertise as a journalist and professor. I will continue to monitor the story. I'm sure it's going to get a lot of air, and just wanted to give perspective on it. Thanks for being here with us, and my love to your wife, too, okay?
I'll give it to her. She's listening.
All right. A wonderful woman. Vicki Thorne, if you're familiar with Project Rachel, she's a great founder of that. That's Dr. Bill Thorne, a wonderful professor emeritus of journalism at Marquette University. Final thought on this. When we come back, we'll change gears. We are all created in the image and likeness of God, right? The image of one God. And we are endowed with with rational souls. This is what the church teaches, that we all have the same nature, the same origin. We've been redeemed by the sacrifice of Christ. And we're all called to participate in that same, as the catechism puts it, beatitude, right? We all have an equal dignity. It's unfortunate that in this day and age that we have lost that perspective. You know, the equality of men, of you, of me, of our brother, you know, whatever part of the world, essentially rests on their dignity as a person and all rights, you know, that flow from that. So church teaches that any form of social or cultural discrimination, whether it's on the grounds of sex or color or race or social condition or language or religion, it's got to be eradicated. It's incompatible with God's design. And that's something that I think we have to examine in our own lives and adjust our vision to see, I guess, our fellow man as God sees him.
Getting you connected. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Governor Henry McMaster has signed into law a bill that would require death row inmates to choose between the electric chair or the firing squad. The new law is expected to allow the state to restart executions after a 10-year pause. The pause was due to a shortage of lethal injection drugs. The new law still keeps lethal drugs as a primary execution method, but the other methods will be required to use if those drugs are not available.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, can you say creepy? Oh my gosh. What would you choose? Okay, you don't get lethal injections, so you don't fall asleep and then your heart and everything else stops, right? Sorry, we're out of our lethal injections, so you got a choice. You can get jolted to death in the electric chair, or you can get shot to death. Unbelievable. You are death row. What would you choose? Something to think about. Hopefully, we'll never have to make that decision, right? That report comes from WYFF TV4. It's an NBC station in Greenville, South Carolina. We're grateful for them. There's also, speaking of prison, there's a bill moving through the Illinois legislature that, according to ABC News, it would limit solitary confinement to more than 10 days per 6 months. Okay, it's a six-month period. Solitary confinement is torture, if you ask me. I know a guy who did 30 days in the hole, and he thought he was going to go crazy. He was begging God for mercy. The bill was developed over the last 10 years. It's been based on the experiences of a man named Anthony Gay. And his story is an interesting one. Back in 2018, he was let out of prison after 2 decades. He was in there for 22 years. He was initially sentenced to 4 years of probation after being in a street fight, right? He stole a hat, and I think it was a dollar bill. He was caught without a license. That was a violation of his parole. So then he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. That 7 years grew. He got assigned to solitary after a fight. He just couldn't deal with it. So his sentence grew again. The amount of time he spent in solitary grew as well. But solitary doesn't just happen to people like Anthony. Cardinal George Pell, who's going to be joining me next week, was put in solitary confinement, supposedly for his own safety, after being wrongly convicted of abusing a couple of choir boys. And Father Gordon McRae, who was on this program recently, who was also falsely accused of sexually abusing a boy and has also had to endure time in solitary confinement. For those men, they had deep faith in God, and that time alone helped them grow in faith. But for most in prison who are there, solitary confinement means being alone almost 24 hours a day, 23 hours at least, without human contact, you know. And if it's prolonged, it can become a torture. That's how Anthony Gay described it, because of that lack of human contact. We're meant to be connected. I'm joined today by Monsignor Stuart Sweatland. He's the president of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas, and also serves as the executive secretary for fellowship of Catholic scholars. Always good to have him back with us. Monsignor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Good to be with you.
Unbelievable stories. You know, I can't imagine solitary confinement for a long period of time. I know this individual who was there, 30 days, he says, was torture, absolute torture for him. The morality of this, I know we've spoken about the death penalty in the past, and we don't have time. I would love to get your take on the firing squad versus the electric chair, but let's talk solitary right now. Why are prisoners sent to solitary, and why do you, I mean, I don't know what you view. I view it as a form of torture. Do you see it the same way?
Well, my first experience with dealing with people who had been long-term in solitary confinement came at the Naval Academy, because many of my chain of command had been prisoners of war in Vietnam. And the communists in Vietnam used solitary as one of their prime means of torture, along with some horrible physical tortures. But even worse than the physical tortures these ex-POWs taught me was the months and years in solitary confinement. Fortunately, they were saved by their strong esprit de corps, in many of their cases, a strong faith in God, and the outstanding leadership of people like Jeremiah Denton and James Stockdale, who created a system, along with Bill Lawrence, of communication by taps that allowed them to have some communication with each other, even while they were strapped down to their beds and, right, and in solitary confinement. No one loses their human dignity. Even a convicted criminal does not lose their human dignity. Each and every one of us, as you eloquently said a few moments ago in your last segment, are created in the image and likeness of God. That imago Dei never goes away, even for someone who's committed a serious crime. And part of what it means to be in the image and likeness of a God who's triune is that we're communal beings. We are social beings. Even the Greek philosopher figured out that the human person is a social being. So to completely cut someone off from all human interaction for a prolonged period of time is denying their human dignity and becomes torturous. And so there should be limits to how long someone can be kept in solitary. Now, the role of prisons, and I just graduated some students from prison. We do our college in prison, so I have the occasion to go in at all three levels, at minimum and medium and maximum security. One of the purposes of prisons is to defend others against the criminal who could be an ongoing threat. So I understand totally why someone needs for their own or others' defense to be separated from the greater community. But even then, there should be ways that social interaction is allowed. If it has to be through glass, if it has to be through plexiglass or whatever, there still should be ways that supervised interaction with other humans is allowed for every person, because that's part of what it means to be human, is interaction with other human beings. And no one should be sentenced to cruel or unusual punishment. And solitary for a long period is both cruel and unusual.
So Anthony Gay, this guy spent 22 years there. I mean, it's tragic how that thing just snowballed.
Well, what you see, if anyone reads his story, what you see, it was a minor crime.
Right.
He stole someone's hat that had a dollar bill on it. He got convicted for robbery. There was a fight, so it was a plea deal. Then he gets caught with driving without a license, and he's sent to do 7 years. But during that 7 years, he's put in solitary for part of it, and he starts to have mental health issues.
Yeah.
The mental health issues leads to misbehaving, and he gets more and more time and more isolations, which makes him more and more sick mentally. That's exactly what happens to humans when they're tortured. They break down mentally, and no wonder. He ended up spending 20 some years in prison for an offense that most of us would say a good talking to and moving on would be enough.
Yeah, it's quite tragic. I think also the great cardinal from Australia, Cardinal Pell, and Father McCray, who was on my program not too long ago, they both spent time in solitary confinement. Both of them, though, had a relationship with God. And I'm sure that makes a big, big difference. But while they suffered, they made it through because they had this deep faith. I mean, what happens without that kind of faith? I mean, I don't know. Right. You know, faith can sustain you. You can offer it up. You can spend time in prayer. If you don't have that, I don't know what that's like. And what do you make of their imprisonments?
Right. Well, of course, Cardinal Pell is one of the great tragedies of modern judicial system. Australia should be ashamed of itself for what they did to him. The case should have been easily thrown out, absolutely, as eventually was, but he spent time in prison. But if you look, Drew, this is one of the amazing things. If you look at the number of saints that spent time in prison, you know, one of my favorite, Maximilian Kolbe, was in Auschwitz. You look at, St. Paul, of course, Peter, you go to almost all the early church martyrs were imprisoned. Thomas More, my confirmation name. You know, you could go through saint after saint after saint who spent time in prison. And they've often turned that time in prison into part of their ministry, part of their ability. Paul wrote from prison. You think of the great Cardinal Francis Xavier Nguyen Van Thuyn, whose cause for canonization is up, was made a cardinal by St. John Paul II. He spent years in solitary confinement. So you can survive it if you have a strong faith, because as Cardinal Newman says, paraphrasing him, you're never less alone than when you're totally alone with God. So for those who have deep faith, you can survive it, but it's still torturous. And the people who did that to those saints were trying to torture them. And despite that attempts, they came through because of their deep faith and the grace of God. I was reading the obituary a year ago of an ex-POW, Sam Johnson, who represented Texas, I think the third district in Texas, if I remember right. He was friends with Jeremiah Denton and Stockdale. They were in the same prisoner of war. He says it was only the grace of God and the mercy of God that allowed him to survive mentally the 42 months he spent in solitary confinement. Jeremiah Denton led a hunger strike in the prison to get him out of solitary because he had been in solitary for so long.
Wow.
But they all say that the most important thing for them in prison was their ability to have the comradeship of their fellow prisoners. And when that's cut off and people are kept isolated, it turns into torture.
So Pope Francis, has he spoken out about this at all? Where's the church? I know he's against the death penalty. So what about solitary?
Right. He talked about it as just in those terms that we don't lose our human dignity, that because we don't lose our human dignity, we can't physically or mentally torture someone. And he considers long periods of isolation to be mental torture.
Yeah. I think of Lucas, my call screener today, sent me a quote from Gaudium et Spes, and it says, God did not create man as a solitary, for from the beginning, male and female, he created them. Their companionship produces from primary form of interpersonal communion. For by his innermost nature, man is a social being. Unless he relates himself to others, he can neither live nor develop his potential. So, lot to say about locking somebody down for months at a time, if not more. I only have a few minutes left, and I do want your take, if you could, on the governor of South Carolina who signed a bill, and this just seems macabre to me. He would force prisoners on death row to choose how they would die. Okay, I'm sorry, we don't have our lethal injection drugs. We ran out of them because we just used them on the prisoner before you. They've got to choose between a firing squad for death or being put in the electric chair. Your take on the governor's decision, and maybe you can even just talk about the death penalty in general.
Right. Well, I mean, I hope we're not going to go backwards in our evolution as a person to something as uncivil as the electric chair. You know, there's plenty of movies one can watch about the electric chair to show you how macabre, as you rightfully say, it is. This just shows you how desperate the people who want to use death as a solution. You know, I've said this to you on your show before, Drew, but we Christians choose life. Death is never a solution to our problems. We never choose death. And no human should ever choose against the good of human life. Yeah. And that's what we put executioners and those who have to carry out these commands of the governor. Yeah. We put them in a situation where they have to will the death of another. No human should ever will the death of another. And with that would eliminate abortion and euthanasia. It would eliminate the death penalty and any other unjust killing where you will the death of another. Now, there's a difference between defending, yep, where death is a side consequence of a just defense action, but we should never choose death. Death is not the solution to our problems. And as the scriptures say, amen, God did not create death.
Thank you, Monsignor. For Donnelly College, what's the web address? Donnellycollege.edu?
Yeah, Donnelly.edu. Donnelly.edu.
Check it out. A great institution. My gratitude to Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, president of Donnelly College. I'll be right back.